loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we're going to examine the latest developments in the so-called Russiagate story. That's a complicated story. We're going to go into it in depth. Then, news outlets around the Middle East reported contradictory information on what is happening around the northern Syria city of Afrin. The Syrian government announced that it would send troops to Afrin to help the Kurds fight Turkish forces. The Kurds initially denied that there is any deal with the Damascus government, but a YPG, that's the Kurds representative, later confirmed to Sputnik that this was in fact the case. Meanwhile, Turkish President Erdogan is claiming that his military shelling has forced the Syrian army to turn around. But first, we take a look at the latest developments in the so-called Russiagate story. But first, we turn to the Mueller investigation. There have been some significant developments. An attorney associated with Manafort associate Rick Gates was charged today with lying to the FBI. Mueller may amend the Manafort indictment, alleging that he laundered more than $40 million in ill-gotten gains. Former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn is also talking about withdrawing his guilty plea. And National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster directly contradicted President Trump, saying that there was Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Meanwhile, the conservatives are calling on Trump to issue a blanket pardon for everyone involved in the scandal. We're joined in studio by Joe Loria. He is a journalist and a political commentator and the author of the book, How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. And we're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer, who is the author of the soon-to-be-released book, The Plot to Attack Iran. Joe and Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Joe Loria, let's start with you. There was the indictment of the 13 Russian entities and three individuals that came on Friday. All through this three-day weekend here in the United States, the media has made the point that this shows incontrovertibly that, in fact, Russia did meddle, although the indictment, when one reads the indictment and one hears Rod Rosenstein explain it, it says that the Trump campaign did not collude with Russia, that no American wittingly colluded with Russia, and that whatever the Russians did, in this case, the IRA, that so-called troll farm, didn't have any impact on the election outcome. Nonetheless, for those who were asserting that this investigation needed something to prove its point, this was seemed to be enough. But of course, what follows now are new developments. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, it's actually worse than that, I think. I think Mueller is substituting quantity for quality here in terms of his indictments. They're coming fast and furious now. This one today, again, has nothing to do with the election. But the 13 Russians who were indicted last week on Friday, I recommend your listeners, if they ever haven't already read it, to read this piece by the anonymous German blogger Moon over Alabama. He lays out a very persuasive case that Russiagate believers would say is a cover story, but if you read it, you cannot help but think that this is true. And that what he says is that this whole operation was a commercial venture and nothing to do with politics. It was an operation by this troll farm in St. Petersburg to get eyeballs in the U.S. They decided in 2014 to expand into the U.S. market. They're doing what hundreds, even thousands of other companies do. It's sleazy, but what they're doing is trying to get eyeballs, to get followers, to sell to their clients. And yes, they have probably had identity theft there, which was a crime. Should they have registered as foreign agents if they were not doing political work? No. So I would recommend reading that and then read the indictment after that. And you'll see there's even a passage in the indictment where they talk about money, $25 to $50 per follower. So it started in 2014, well before the election began. There are both Clinton, pro and anti-Clinton, pro and anti-Trump, pro-LGBT, anti-LGBT ads that were on, or these protests that they supposedly organized, and some only had eight people coming to them or no people coming to them. So how could you explain that they were taking both sides of all the issues? The Russiagate believer says they were sowing discord in the United States and undermining our democracy, shades of the 1950s, of course, the first Cold War. The United States has enormous problems of its own. It does not need 13 Russians to come here and stir that up. So if you see this as a commercial venture, you will see, and Mueller had to know this. He had to know this, and he put this indictment forward anyway because he knew that there will be no extraditions. It'll never go to court. He doesn't have to prove any of these charges. So he can go on the town and I think maybe even make up quotes, like a quote where one of these 13 supposedly wrote an email saying that the FBI, they got me. I mean, nobody on a real operation would write something like that, right, John?
Never.
The CIA, you would know.
Never.
Prosecutors have been known to make things up before, even in cases that were going to go to court.
Amen.
So, yes, you would know. Tom Drake would know exactly. So, I think you got to see this in those terms. This was a laughable indictment. But it's not going away. And Mueller knew that the corporate media in the U.S. would cover it the way he wanted it to, the way it should be, in terms of those who are pushing this anti-Russian agenda. It's a very dangerous agenda, and that includes McMaster. That includes McMaster, which is why he opposes president.
I want to ask both of you a question, and we can start with Dan Kovalik. You know, when this whole thing first started and the first few indictments were issued, and one of them was for Mike Flynn, the former national security advisor. There were four sealed indictments. They were sealed here in the district court of the District of Columbia. Now, subsequently, we have seen a whole bunch of other indictments. Joe, as you just pointed out, they have nothing to do with Russia or with election interference. They have to do with things like money laundering or a lot of them just making a false statement to the FBI. But there's nothing substantive here. And without this investigation, there wouldn't have been a crime in the first place. So are we looking at these four still sealed indictments being something similar, making a false statement, conspiracy, silly throwaway felonies? Or are we looking at serious charges, do you think? And I also note the New York Times today saying that Mueller is taking a closer and closer look at Jared Kushner, not because Jared Kushner had anything to do with the Russians and the election, but because he may have violated some technical financial law when trying to refinance his family's giant $1.8 billion office tower on Fifth Avenue. Dan, why don't you start?
Yes. Well, it's hard to know what's in those sealed files.
Sure.
Certainly one might think that he could be saving the best for last, the best in this case, from his point of view, being the most damning, something that, you know, would at least point to collusion. But yet this has been going on for so long, and he hasn't produced one iota of evidence yet that shows any collusion between the Trump camp and the Russians. And as Joe pointed out, I mean, the indictment against these 13 folks from the so-called troll farm that some Russiagate enthusiasts now are saying is a smoking gun is nothing of the sort. I'm actually looking, as we're speaking here, to the text of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And it grants free speech rights not to citizens but to people. Okay, some of the bill rights are only limited to citizens. The point being that Russian people, any people, have a right to free speech within the United States that cannot be abridged. The fact that they're Russian doesn't mean that they can't speak on issues of the day. And of course, the only reason they're being indicted is because they are Russian. If they were Canadian and doing the same thing, or American and doing the same thing, this would not be an issue.
Or if Hillary Clinton had won, I mean, this would not have become a thing.
That's
it
wouldn't.
But go ahead,
it would have gone away.
I did mean to interrupt you, but I don't mean for you to stop. Go ahead.
Yeah, but so I mean, this is worse than kind of a joke. I mean, it's a joke in the sense that there's really nothing here. And again, I mean, one of the allegations is that they pretended to be Americans. You know, as if that's in itself unlawful. You know, it is unlawful to pretend to be a cop or a priest, but not to just pretend to be an American. You know, it's a kind of a bizarre claim. But again, the danger here is that this is abridging free speech rights. And the fact that they happen to be Russian, what if they were actually in the country?
Well, but let me let me ask you, Dan. But here, I agree with almost your entire presentation. But of course, if the Russian troll farm is stealing people's identity or creating false personas to mislead people, one, it's in the first case not legal. In the second case, certainly not ethical. Which doesn't mean free speech has to be ethical, but let's not trivialize that. That's a serious thing, I would say. But what we see is that all of the different campaigns actually do this. They all create, they all have their own troll farms, in fact. And Jill's, you know, I want to talk about Jill Stein, if we could, because now Jill Stein and the Green Party are being dragged into this thing. The Senate Intelligence Committee was... The Richard Burr and Warner charging that they're looking into Green Party collusion. David Axelrod, the campaign manager of Obama, said Trump beat Hillary Clinton by 12,000 votes in Michigan. Jill Stein got 50,000. Russia boosted Jill Stein, the Green Party, smart tactic. And now you have Howard Dean and MSNBC. They're all ganging up on Jill Stein. And Jill Stein went on MSNBC on Sunday, and I thought she did a fantastic job, a really great job, because it would be easy to do like what Bernie Sanders is doing in an unprincipled way, which is just to say, yes, I fully agree. The Russians intervened. They were trying to help me, blah, blah, blah. In other words, sort of undercutting the relevance of his own campaign as if everything that we, the progressive people on the left do, or anything anybody does that's not the mainstream, is somehow a stooge or a puppet of a foreign power. But Jill Stein pointed out on MSNBC, in spite of the hostile questioning, she said, look, what they're asserting is that this troll farm, the Internet Research Agency, purchased one Facebook post for me, one. And the MSNBC host was demanding, so it's possible, Jill, isn't it, that you unwittingly were supported by the Russians? And Jill Stein was saying, no, what impacted the election was that we were excluded from the debates. What impacted on the election was that Donald Trump got $600 million in free advertising, or $6 million in free advertising, because the big media mogul said it's bad for the country, but good for ratings. They made Donald Trump a thing. She was talking like that. She was really doing a very admirable job. And of course, afterwards, the YouTube, that presentation of it that's put up about Jill Stein's great performance, not performance, but argument on MSNBC, the YouTube labeled as Jill Stein goes berserk, because she wasn't willing to go along with the witch hunt.
This is Sanders is disgraceful, but this tells us he's going to run 2020. No question about that. He said if Hillary Clinton had won, this wouldn't be happening. If Sanders had won, maybe it would be. They'd be tying him to Russia, and that's what they tried to do in this document. I think the overall thing involved here, in my view, is that the establishment in this country is nervous. They are under threat. They're in crisis. Because their neoliberal project the last 30 years is fraying at the seams. And how do they know that? They saw the 2016 election. There was an enormous insurgency on left and right. Unfortunately, the right wing won with Trump. So Trump, Sanders, and to a much lesser extent, Jill Stein, are threats to the establishment. So these indictments are in a way to smear them with Russia. I mean, if you go back to the Cold War when George H.W. Bush said that Bill Clinton had gone to Moscow, you know, this is an old tactic, but there's another part of it as well, the geostrategic interests against Russia and getting dominance over that country again and not letting Russia stand in the way of U.S. geostrategic interests around the world. So in many ways, these indictments, particularly the one on Friday, reminded me of any tin pot dictator who's blaming foreign influence for legitimate domestic unrest, which is what we've got here.
I think that's the big issue. Dan Kovalik, I think Joe is right. I think when we read the indictment, we said, first and foremost, this is actually a war against dissent. This is a war against the free speech. It's a war against the exercise of free speech. It's a war against especially the Black Lives Matter movement, the Green movement, the peace movement, those who are defying the Washington ruling class establishment consensus are now being targeted. If you were in the streets, if you were protesting even against Trump, as the indictment reads, after the election, that too was an extension of Russian influence. So everything we, the people, do is now the byproduct of a foreign power's manipulation, which is exactly what Bull Connor used to say to Martin Luther King. The reason black people were rising up in the South was because of outside communist agitators who in turn were inspired by the Soviet Union. It's the same thing.
It's exactly the same thing. Go ahead, Dan.
It is. Well, and in fact, the Council on Foreign Relations, which is the most influential foreign policy think tank, has said we are in a second Cold War with Russia. They were denying it for some time, but they've now said, they've declared we're in a second Cold War with Russia. And it's true, if the first one even really ended. But the point is, as you're saying, what that means for us, amongst other things, is that they will try to link anyone who says any word of dissent is somehow being a pawn of Russia. And it wasn't true during the first Cold War, and it's even less true now because, you know, no one claims to share the ideological feelings of the current Russian government. They're capitalist as much as the U.S. is. You know, it's not. This isn't a battle of
ideologies. During the Cold War, the communists and socialists were considered a fifth column, even though socialists and communists and anarchists have been a big part of American history throughout. They were called a fifth column of an enemy power, and that enemy power had thermonuclear weapons pointed at the U.S. But these people, the left, were the ideological supporters of the Soviet socialist experiment, where now what they're really asserting, what the real assertion is, and in a way it's even more dangerous because the broad brush is so, well, it's so broader. It's you're an unwitting dupe. Like all of us who do anything are either witting, but in most cases, unwitting dupes. But that in itself discredits what we're doing. Go ahead, Dan. Finish out, and then let's toss it back to Joe.
Yeah, and I guess the best example or most enigmatic one is that they claimed that the Kaepernick, activism, the kneeling on the sidelines was
right.
Somehow, that he was somehow an unwitting dupe, which then becomes, frankly, racist.
It's
you know, that African Americans can't decide they're being oppressed and they can't decide on their own what to do about it. You know, they have to be the puppets of the Russians, which is such a slap on the face to these people.
I'd like to, if you don't mind, I'd like to change tacks here a little bit. There's been some reporting, but only in the conservative media today, that Mike Flynn, General Michael Flynn, the former National Security Advisor, may withdraw his guilty plea, change it back to not guilty, and fight. And the reason he's considering doing this, again, according to the conservative media, is because the Republicans have been so successful in staying united on this issue and in beating up on Mueller and Mueller's team and the FBI that they believe the narrative is now that Mueller and the FBI are crooked, that this is nothing more than a conspiracy against the Trump administration, and that no jury would find him guilty. Dan Loria, do you think there's anything to this?
Well, you know, let's see if Christopher Steele is arrested for lying to the FBI the way General Flynn was.
Right.
That's the allegation.
Yes.
That he lied that he didn't talk to the media, in which he created this loop where he was confirming his own information by talking off the record to Yahoo and then lying to the FBI about that. It's extraordinary to think that I would, and a lot of us on the left would be supporting Republicans on something.
Crazy,
but they
isn't
seem
it?
To be doing their job. The job of the House and Senate Intelligence Committee is to be the oversight of the intelligence agencies, not the other way around.
Exactly.
And they got so attacked for trying to do their job, essentially. So, yes, that has to be looked at because they can't get away with this. Unfortunately, they're motivated by partisan motives. I think most of us on the left aren't. We want to see the intelligence agencies reined in, finally, or as they almost were in the 70s. So it's interesting that Flynn has done this, and as far as those sealed indictments, by the way, I wanted to make a comment about that because there was a story in the Wall Street Journal, I think in November, which said that they had about to bring charges against 6 or 7 Russians who hacked the DNC.
Right.
What's happened to that?
Yeah.
Could
Nobody
that
talks
be the
about
sealed
that
indictment?
Anymore. It
yeah,
could
that's
be.
That's gone away. Because that's what I thought this was when I saw the headline, Mueller's indicted 13 people. I said, oh, they finally got it. You know, this is it. They got the guys who hacked the DNC. Then I started reading the indictment. And it's the same way I reacted to the Flynn indictment and the other and the Manafort indictment, that there's nothing there in terms of the Russian collusion story.
That's why I like what Jill Stein is doing. She, from the left, is standing up. And sadly, so many people in the left have capitulated to this. But she's standing up and saying, look, when I went to Russia, because they're making a big deal out of the fact that she went to the RT 10th anniversary dinner, and she sat at a table, and at that table for a few minutes also was Vladimir Putin. When she went to Russia, she put on her website, I'm going to Russia. I'm going to the RT 10th anniversary dinner. She didn't have anybody else pay her way. She paid her way. She said, I want to meet with Putin. I want to meet with Lavrov. I want to meet with Xi Jinping. I'm pursuing a policy of peace. But the moment she got the nomination, that's when it started. The moment she got the Green Party nomination, the Democrats opened up after ignoring completely everything she was saying and doing, including going to this dinner. Jill Stein colluding with Russia, because actually the Democrats, as Joe was pointing out, they actually fear independent movements. They fear third parties. 61% of the American people, according to a recent poll, think that we should have a third party. If that's true, if the duopoly loses its control, if people actually start to say, the heck with this stuff, in spite of all the money, in spite of the fact that $2.4 billion is spent by the Republicans and Democrats, we're going grassroots, we're going third party, we're going left, we're going Greens, we're going socialists, we're going anything independent. That's a big problem for the establishment parties. So now they're demonizing Jill Stein and the Green Party. And I have to say, shame on all of those liberals, including some who probably voted for Jill Stein, but they're backing down, they're capitulating. If you capitulate to the witch hunt, then the inferno just grows and grows and grows. That's what happened with the 40s and the 50s.
That's right.
The ACLU started naming names. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, you know, I'll just, you know, if we want to add a little entertainment news in here, you know, if you guys saw Black Panther over the weekend, perchance, which is being portrayed as this great, you know, progressive film, you know, one of the good guys in it is with the CIA. You know, and that's what we've done. Now, all of a sudden, the CIA is our friend somehow, and the FBI is our friend. Well, it's never been our friend. It's never been the friend of progressive people, certainly never of African-American people. And yet now we're being led to believe that's the case. And again, that's what this Russiagate is doing. And now you have bizarrely, as Joe was saying, the Republicans fighting that characterization. But the folks on the left need to be even more aggressive in fighting that characterization at this time.
I think it's imperative. I think you can't go around building a progressive movement in America and say, well, we want higher wages or we want more affordable housing, but we're going to turn our back or actually capitulate with a government-sponsored, an FBI-sponsored, intelligence agency-sponsored witch hunt, which is so familiar, similar to the old Cold War. Let's just look at some numbers here. The total election spending was $2.4 billion, as I mentioned. The total Russian Facebook ad buy was about 100,000. That's what the government is asserting. The total Clinton-Trump Facebook ad buy was $81 million.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're talking about is IRA, the Internet Research Agency, which may be a commercial enterprise, getting clickbaits,
sure,
getting paid for it. They're like an amateurish, clownish group. Don't have good English skills even. They're playing both sides of the fence. They're not even advocating for a particular candidate. Now, in terms of the ad buys, in Michigan, the ad buys from this company were $832. That's in Michigan. That's a swing state, $832. And all but 54 of those dollars, I mean, in Wisconsin, all but 54 of the $1,974 spent by the IRA, all but $54 were spent before the primary, not even in the general election. So when you look at these numbers, it's obvious that this thing, the IRA, Internet Research Agency, didn't have any influence whatsoever. None. I mean, let's put it out there. It had no influence. And the fact that one Facebook post for Jill Stein's Green Party is asserted by the enemies of independent politics to be proof that she's an extension of Russian power is one of the biggest disgraces. And unless the left gets it together, unless the left stops because of our understandable opposition to Donald Trump, But unless we get together and stand up and unite and say no to this thing, this inferno will devour the First Amendment. That's where it's going. It's serious. Go ahead, Joe.
I couldn't agree more. Just to add a few more numbers, 44% of those ads came before the election. That means 56 came after the election, and nothing to do with it. $1.2 million budget a month, IRA, the press keeps telling us, the corporate media. In fact, that's the entire budget of the company for a month. And they work in other countries. They work inside Russia. So they were not spending that on that, letting that misleading statement stay out there. We've got a situation where, as you say, dissent is being suppressed by corporate media, but people are not believing it anymore. And that's part of the erosion of the confidence and the strength of the establishment. And the corporate media is there to underpin the elite. That's what the establishment does. And the people who work in corporate media, and I did for over almost 30 years, including 6 years of the Wall Street Journal and the Boston Globe, et cetera. So I've been on the inside a long time. Careerism is rampant there. They're getting close to people in government, just getting access. It's about having careerism, to be to have a good job and to be famous. And this is leading people in the corporate media to just run with this Russia story because it also threatens themselves because they're dependent on the establishment.
There can't be a good witch hunt, Dan Kovalik, without a lot of opportunism because a lot of people actually know better, but it's just fashionable. It's good, as Joe Lauria is saying, good for your career to go along.
You see that on Twitter and Facebook all the time. I follow a lot of journalists who are not necessarily mainstream journalists, but journalists I respect, or at least respected until they decided to completely buy into this Russia narrative and just repeat what the corporate media has been trying to force feed us for the last year.
Dan Kovalik, 20 seconds, you get the last word.
Yeah, well, I think people should go back and read The Crucible again, you know, and relearn about, you know, mob mentality. And yes, people jumping on the bandwagon and pointing the finger lest the finger be pointed at them. And it's a very dangerous situation.
And of course, we also have the admission by James Woolsey, former CIA director on Fox News. Of course, America interferes in other countries' elections, but it's always for a good cause.
That's right. That's
always
what he
for
said.
A good cause. We've been joined in studio by Joe Lauria. He is a journalist and political commentator and the author of the book, How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. And we're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of the soon-to-be-released book, The Plot to Attack Iran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
News outlets around the Middle East reported contradictory information on what is happening around the northern Syrian city of Afrin. The Syrian government announced that it would send troops to Afrin to help the Kurds, the YPG, fight Turkish forces. The Kurds initially denied that there was any deal with Damascus, but a YPG representative later confirmed to Sputnik that this was in fact the case. Meanwhile, the Turkish president Erdogan is claiming that his military shelling has forced the Syrian army to turn around. We're joined from the UK by Ambassador Peter Ford. He is the former UK ambassador to Syria. And we're joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Rick Sterling. He is an investigative journalist and member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Peter Ford, let's start with you. It is contradictory information. What do you know?
Well, it is a very murky situation. I don't pretend to have the latest correct news. Your guess is probably as good as mine, but some things are quite clear. And one is that the Turks have kind of agreed to a face favor whereby the Syrian government forces will enter free and under certain conditions. And according to the Turks, one of those conditions will be the disarming of the YPG. Now, something may have gone wrong at the last minute, or the Syrians may have changed their minds. But the other thing that's clear is the determination of the Syrian government to reclaim every last square kilometer of Syrian sovereign territory. This is the real story here. This is the latest bit of Syria that will soon be recovered by the government. And what the Syrian government is doing in Afrin is a lesson to the Kurds in who they can count on when the chips are down, and a lesson to America, which is next up in Manbij.
Rick Sterling, the Kurds all of this is taking place in the northern part of Syria, but there's the western part around Afrin and a little bit to the east, Manbij, but past the Euphrates, east of the Euphrates, there's a different situation, a different constellation of forces, because that's where the American military is and embedded with the Kurdish units, the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces. Do you agree with Ambassador Ford that the Syrian government, one, is determined to take back every last square kilometer of territory, and whether or not what's about to happen is just that, at least west of the Euphrates?
Yes, I do believe that's the case. Syria's been very clear about this from the start, and actually Russia has spoken about this very directly as well, that Syrian sovereignty and the territorial integrity of the country is essential. They have to fight their battles one at a time for the most part, and right now it's focused on Afrin. I think it may be significant that Erdogan in the last 24 hours talked about laying siege to Afrin rather than a full-scale assault right on the city. So that may be a way of postponing things to see how things develop. But at this point, I think it's a positive indication that the Syrian government is moving into Afrin. And we speak about the Kurds, but first and foremost, they're Syrian. And while there's some separatist elements there, I think the larger element recognizes that they're Syrian first and foremost.
Ambassador Peter Ford, Al-Masdar News, which is an official news outlet in Syria, is reporting that the government began what it's calling a huge attack across East Damascus as a ground offensive looms. It says it tweeted that a couple of hours ago. And then British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, a human rights organization, not in Syria but watching Syria, says that the government has killed more than 70 and wounded more than 300 in this effort to retake East Damascus and those suburbs outside of East Damascus. Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, this area known as the Eastern Ghouta is home to about 350,000 people. It's several kilometers, it's a square of several kilometers length and breadth, mostly agricultural, several small towns, and it's been infested with jihadis and various cutthroat brigands for the last 7 years. It's been a no-go area for the government. And during that time, these jihadis, and they include ISIS, by the way, this is never mentioned by the Western media, but there are pockets, including the former Palestinian refugee camp of Yarmouk, which I know personally very well, is totally controlled by ISIS. So what's going on is that the government, fed up of having these people on its Damascus doorstep lobbing shells into eastern Damascus on a regular basis, and again, this is something Western media rarely mention, fed up with this, has decided that enough is enough, and although it will be painful, they have to recover this territory, and it looks like they've taken the final decision to do so.
That's the voice of Peter Ford. Peter Ford is the former UK ambassador to Syria. He is joined with us on Loud and Clear from San Francisco by Rick Sterling. Rick is an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. You can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. or go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. And if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and 1390 AM. Rick Sterling, let's go back to you. Let's talk about Afrin, the place, because, you know, for most people, we only start to learn about it when it's the scene of a battle. But it's a historic spot. It seems to be has water. It has agriculture. It's predominantly Kurdish in terms of who lives there. As far as I understand, hundreds of Kurdish, small Kurdish villages. But talk about, if you would, how Afrin became such a critical pivot now in the war.
Well, it's a mountainous area, and that's a region of Syria that the Syrian Arab Army kind of withdrew from, and they more or less passed the baton of fighting terrorism to the YPG early on in the struggle. And actually, Afrin has not seen a whole lot of battles, so this is kind of a new situation where the Turkish army has, let's just put it bluntly the way it is, the Turkish army has invaded Syria. And the irony here is that they're claiming they're doing it to prevent terrorism, when the truth of the matter is that Turkey was the avenue, was the gateway, was the passage point for terrorists. It was actually the place where terrorist planning and operations and training went on for the conflict. So it's hugely cynical and ironic to hear Turkey speaking about stopping terrorism as they invade their neighboring country, Syria. But I just want to make a little comment to back up what Ambassador Ford was saying about East Ghouta and the importance of that. And we can see the coming importance of that by looking at the Western media, where the New York Times has a prominent story today, Syrian bombardment kills nearly 100 in Eastern Ghouta. The number keeps changing. The London Guardian is also a good benchmark for the Western promotion of things. And they've got a story out today or yesterday. East Ghouta is another Srebrenica. And they put out some different numbers. According to them, 200 civilians have been killed.
People might not know what that means.
Referring back to Yugoslavia and the killing during the conflict in the breakup of Yugoslavia. And it was widely reported there was a huge massacre in Srebrenica that became a major media point. But the reference to that, in the past, we've seen references to Guernica, which is a famous the town of a famous bombardment by Nazis during the Spanish Civil War. But the point is that we're seeing a real uptick in media accusations that there's all these civilians being killed in East Ghouta, with absolutely no mention of the fact that this area is the camp of the terrorists who have been bombing Damascus for the last 7 years. And I've been a witness, and I witnessed to that both when I was there in 2014 and 2015. Mortars landed right outside our hotel in Damascus, fired from East Ghouta. And the other important thing which is missing, and there's a lot of deception around, is that there's actually very few civilians remaining in East Ghouta. 90% left long time ago, and there are some that are imprisoned there by some of the terrorist factions. And there's some of the terrorists will have their families with them, but by and large, there's very few civilians remaining in East Ghouta.
Is that why we're not really hearing anything about a new refugee crisis, that there just isn't a new refugee crisis because the refugees that were able to get out have already gotten out?
Sure. The people fled there, whether it was from Yarmouk or from East Ghouta. The civilians who departed quickly when the terrorists came in and took over regions or districts, a lot of them would go and stay with family or friends in Damascus. Some of them finally, you know, ended up having to leave the country to go to visit family or stay with family in Lebanon in the case of Palestinians.
Yeah. Ambassador Ford, we mentioned earlier the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. You're in London. They're in London. Talk about that organization, what it does, what its political stance is, because it's largely quoted in the Western media. And as a consequence, most people consider it to be a believable, credible source. Just help us with that, if you would.
Well, actually, this is a guy in Birmingham, UK's second biggest city, in his bedroom. Honestly, I am not kidding you. And this guy claims to have informants all over Syria. He probably gets funds from the British Foreign Office. I don't have proof of that, but I'd be very surprised, knowing how they work, having been there myself, if he didn't get money from that source. And a reliable source of propaganda for the jihadis. He throws in some tidbits as well, which are actually true now and again. But this is the same guy who, before Aleppo, was peddling this story that there were a quarter of a million people who were going to be massacred, and that ended up as 35,000 who were bussed out, and the worst that had to happen to them was that they were waiting a couple of hours in the cold for the buses. That's the kind of operation this observatory is.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the Wikipedia page. The organization is run by Rami Abdulrahman, sometimes referred to as Rami Rahman, from his home in Coventry. He is a Syrian Sunni Muslim who owns a clothes shop. Born Osama Sulaiman, he adopted a pseudonym during his years of activism. He's apparently a one-man show. But anyway, widely reported, Rick Sterling, widely used by the Western media to document all of the atrocities. I'm using air quotes because the liberation of Eastern Aleppo from jihadi terrorist organizations, including Al-Qaeda, was considered an atrocity, not a liberation. And most of the Western media sources used the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights as the source. It had the word Syria in it. It had the word human rights in it. So why not? But a one-man show.
Right. Yeah, well, that's the sad thing. The descent of journalism in the Syrian war is really reaching new lows. And the reports now coming from East Ghouta usually rely predominantly on people who are not there, or if they are there, they're it's the White Helmets, which is an organization paid by the West. So they feed the stories that that the West likes to hear.
Can I jump
in there just about the White Helmets? Isn't it ironic that today the news breaks that the guy behind the White Helmets film that's up for the Oscars has been denied a visa? Isn't it wonderful? It is so rich. Yeah.
I want to, Ambassador Ford, let's stay with you, but on a slightly different, well, not a slightly different, a completely different topic. I want to talk about Turkey and Erdogan's orientation towards this crisis, because it's going through so many different iterations, so many different cycles. And each new cycle is preceded by what appears to be the catastrophe of the preceding policy. So the initial policy was, as was the policy in Washington and NATO countries and Saudi Arabia and Qatar, was to call for the overthrow of the Assad government. Assad must go. That was the mantra. And it appeared then that Turkey, Erdogan, had sort of a larger neo-Ottoman Empire fantasy of reincorporating Syria or big parts of it back into a Turkish zone of influence. And at that time, and during that time, relations between Turkey and Russia soured. Turkey shot down a Russian fighter aircraft. I mean, then Russia took countermeasures and imposed sanctions on Turkey. Then, of course, it became clear that Assad wasn't going to fall, especially after the decisive intervention of the Russian government, but also with the allies Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Iranian militias. And then the Turkish-Russian relationship repaired, and Turkey, along with Iran and Russia, became the guarantors for a peace process that would ultimately lead to an end to the war in Syria and create a new post-war Syrian government configuration, hopefully led by Syrians. But here you have Turkey again in a confrontational mode, now with the United States. And of course, Turkey is the eastern flank of NATO, the second largest military in NATO, and NATO is a U.S.-led military alliance. And that also puts Turkey on a collision course, or a kind of collision course. Collision course may be an exaggeration, with Russia as well. So just help us understand what what Turkey is actually trying to achieve, and what accounts for these different stages, cycles, phases, iterations.
Well, Erdogan appears to be a Turkish Donald Trump. He veers all over the shop with delusions of grandeur and just not very smart. He's gotten his army into deep trouble, it seems, in Afrin. It's remarkable that, 25 days into the incursion, they still haven't reached the town of Afrin. I think it's worth remembering two things. One, that the Turkish army hasn't fought a real war with another military since 1974, when it had a walkover in Cyprus. It doesn't have the kind of experience that even the Peshmerga have. And second, the Turkish army institutionally is not the number one fan of Erdogan. Institutionally, the army has been historically a secular institution. And Erdogan has had large-scale purges of the army. So he'd kind of better watch out what he's doing with that instrument.
Brian, I'd like to comment on that as well. I think Ambassador Ford is 100% correct. And I think I would go a little farther even. I think that Erdogan has been so embarrassed over the years by the West, by the United States and the European Union, because he wasn't allowed into the European Union. And as much as Turkey wanted to become a European country, it's not a European country. It'll likely never be a European country. And that was after Turkey even went so far as to change some of its laws, like doing away with the death penalty after the capture of Abdullah Öcalan, the founder of the PKK. So I think that Erdogan feels that he's been embarrassed. And because of that, he, or in part at least because of that, he's decided to take policy positions that are the opposite of what the rest of the alliance is willing to take. Ambassador Ford makes an important point here, too, that the army, the military in Turkey, has traditionally been secular. And any time there was a hint of Turkey turning toward a more religious form of government, they would intervene. And they've intervened a half a dozen times over the course of the last century, since the founding of modern Turkey. And, I think all in all, this comes down to weak leadership on the part of Erdogan. Without the kind of backing that the leader of a major country should expect or should be able to move forward with.
Those are very interesting points. And I want Rick Sterling to, let's stay on this subject. I think you actually can't understand what's going on without understanding what Syria's motives are, Turkey's motives and Turkey's agenda, and the status of the Erdogan government. And again, I want, Rick, if you would, to sort of talk about what this Turkish-Russian relationship is, because it's filled with contradictions. Obviously, Russia sees in Turkey and in Iran a possible alliance that would be free from complete U.S. domination. And yet it's a very unstable relationship. The coup the failed coup in Turkey that took place in July 2016, that the Obama administration apparently failed to warn Erdogan about, even though it may have had advance notice, if not giving a green light, maybe a yellow light to it. Since that time, Erdogan has carried out major purges in the Turkish military and in Turkish civil society and even in the parliament, about 70,000 post-coup arrests. I think that's the number of people who have been arrested. Probably many more have lost their jobs. Anyway, let's talk about the stability of the current Turkish government and sort of unpack the Turkish-Russian relationship. What do both countries want from it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Erdogan is trying to play off Russia against the U.S. and NATO. I totally agree with Ambassador Ford's characterization, delusions of grandeur. And a Turkish Donald Trump is kind of an amusing and a little bit upsetting, but accurate description. I think Russia is hoping that they can basically win over Erdogan. They've actually made some progress with the alliance with Iran and Turkey and Russia at the Astana talks, and then more recently at the Sochi talks. They're trying to do some breakthroughs. It's turning out that Russia is the real diplomat in the region now. The dangerous thing is that Erdogan is using nationalism to try to consolidate his grasp on power. In June of 2015, in that election, he did not win the majority that he was expecting. The People's Democratic Party, the HDP, which is the third largest party, and which is a party which unites progressives of various ethnicities in Turkey, surged and was making real headway. Now, I think it was yesterday, the former co-chair of that party was released from prison, which is an idea of which is just evidence of what you're referring to. The fact that there's an astounding number of people who have been imprisoned and an astounding amount of repression and censorship going on in Turkey. And I think it's a very interesting point that the army that is now suffering losses in their invasion of Syria at what point will resistance to Erdogan become more overt? So that's another factor in the mix here. 5 days ago, Tillerson had a three-hour meeting with Erdogan, and the foreign minister acted as the translator. So I think they may have been concerned about the secrecy of the meetings or of they're not having leaks get out. In any case, I think Erdogan is trying to play both sides of the fence, and time will tell. But it's a dangerous situation, the Syrian government is just taking things step by step, it seems.
90 seconds left. Ambassador Ford, my final question to you is this. It appeared, at least from here, about a month ago, that as a consequence of the rising tide of Turkish nationalism, that Erdogan, even though while he had support, obviously, in a big part of the country, didn't have support in other sectors, including progressive people and certainly the secular movements, that he started to gain some traction on the basis of a wave of nationalism, everybody sort of getting in line, saluting the flag as the country was going to war. But of course, if wars don't work out, then the opposite turns out to be the case. What's your estimate right now? We have about a little bit more than a minute.
Well, I think he must be very worried, and that's why he's made this move to try to lay siege, have something concrete to show for a month's military work, lay siege to the city of Afrin. But if he fails to do that, questions will inevitably be asked inside Turkey. And as the body bags go back, I would expect more questioning. And then he's made rash promises to retake Mandij. There's trouble brewing on that front as well, just around the corner.
Yeah, and actually, we do have 30 more seconds. Just want to ask you, Ambassador Ford, is America going to ever leave Syria? 30 seconds.
Yes, ultimately, you look at the history of Syria, the invaders always end up leaving, and it always ends up costly for them. But I reckon it will take about a year to winkle Uncle Sam out of Syria.
Okay, extremely interesting. All right, that was the voice of Ambassador Peter Ford, former UK ambassador to Syria. We talked to him from London. We have also been joined from San Francisco or the San Francisco Bay Area by Rick Sterling. He is an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.